鬼岛之音
Ghost Island Media。Welcome back to the Taiwan Take. I'm your host, Emily Wai Wu. Today, I'm welcoming into our studio filmmaker S. Leo Jiang, who has just been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Short. Welcome.
Thank you, Emily. Happy to be here.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so today we'll talk about the film called Island in Between. It's your personal perspective at the, quote, uneasy peace on the front line between Taiwan and China. The film is about Kingmen. For our audience who may not be familiar with Kingmen, it is an outer island of Taiwan. But geographically, it's much, much closer to China. If you've watched a film, you can see China from the shores of Kingmen. It's about 2 miles away from the Bay of Xiamen. The 19-minute film is produced by Cinex in Taiwan and distributed by the New York Times Op Docs. This is the first Oscar nomination for a documentary from Taiwan. The last time that a Taiwanese film was at the Oscars was 2001.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
That's right. It won Best Foreign Language Film and nominated for Best Picture and Best Director for An Li also. Tell me about that moment you found out you were in Portugal. You were at a square, public square.
Well, I was trying to play it cool. I was like, oh, you know, everybody's going to be like, you know, sitting in front of the TV, in front of the computer and like waiting. But I'm you know, I'm chill. I'm just going to go hang around the flea market. But, you know, of course, like when the time of the announcement comes up, we got nervous and my partner and another friend we were with and I were like, okay, let's go sit down somewhere so we can watch. And then he started video using his phone to tape me of the moment of reaction. So it's pretty damn exciting. You know, I'm not going to pretend that this is not one of my bucket lists. As somebody, you know, who loves documentary filmmaking, who has committed 20 plus years to this, like, it's an amazing acknowledgement.
Let's talk about the path to the Oscars.
Well, I mean, you know, we didn't necessarily make this film thinking that that's the goal, right? We thought that it was a great time to tell Taiwanese stories. You know, for folks who pay attention to Taiwan from the international side, we all know that for a long time, Taiwan was only talked about in the context of China or in the context of U.S. But, you know, last few years, some for good things and some for not so good things, Taiwan has been on people's awareness much more. And we just felt like, hey, this is a perfect time to tell Taiwanese stories, to do something that complement all the actually really great reporting that's been happening about Taiwan out there, which tends to be fact-based, maybe more about geopolitical situation analysis, news, all of that. But I just felt like, hey, let's do a sort of an emotional look at what it's like to be in Taiwan, to be Taiwanese at this moment for those folks out there who might not know. So that was always kind of the initial sort of motivation to do this piece.
When did you begin shooting this documentary? Well, it was finished just 3 months ago.
Yeah, crazy. So you mentioned Cinex, which is a documentary foundation / production company here in Taiwan. Its CEO is Ben Jiang. Also Ruby Chen, who's actually now based in Beijing, but who's Taiwanese. The two of them plus Zhang Zhaowei. They started it.
Cinex is a powerhouse in the Mandarin documentary world. They have a pitching forum that you were a part of for many years. They have a TV channel of documentaries, so a little bit like the Sundance of Mandarin language films. They produce just amazing documentaries.
And one of the things that I thought they've done extremely well, probably better than all the other documentary entities in Taiwan, is they built a really strong set of relationships with the international documentary community. So if you go out to Europe, to North America, and you ask about Taiwanese documentaries or even Chinese language documentary in general, this is the first group that comes to mind for them. So funny enough, both Ben and I had gone to Jimin for the very first time, and we're both really excited and really curious about the place, about its history, about its current state, about it being both a place that could represent Taiwan, but also a place that is so different from the main Taiwan island in terms of its culture and
people's attitude towards the strait situation across the strait.
Yeah, Dingmen and Matsu. So Matsu is the kind of the twin brother to Dingmen. Both of them are front lines between Taiwan and China. Both of them share this history where they are now a part of Taiwan, but they did not go through the Japanese colonization that Taiwan did. So it has a very different identity compared to the mainland of Taiwan. And it also didn't go through the pro-democracy movements that Taiwan witnessed. And so it's a very different place from where Taiwan is. But you're right. I mean, growing up here, you hear all about these two places, but you don't exactly visit. My father was also stationed in Dingmen, right? So we hear about Dingmen from his perspective as a conscript back in the days. That's not something that they would like to go back to.
I still have to get myself to Matsu. Super fascinated by that place. And I think Dingmen and Matsu definitely occupy this sort of mythical place in the Taiwanese consciousness, right? And my father and also our producer, Jin Chen, her uncle was also stationed there. We've all heard these stories, not necessarily flattering stories, I might add, about Dingmen and Matsu, because it was always seen through the conscript's point of view, which is that it's a difficult place to be. They're young and they're away from their family and they're constantly being warned about the threat. So they're not necessarily looking at the beautiful nature or the amazing, you know, like Minnan, southern Chinese architecture that was there.
Which is so different from the mainland of Taiwan. It is so beautiful.
So beautiful. So beautiful. So I think both Ben had that response, right? The visceral response of like, this is not what we thought it would be. And it's so interesting. So what can we do to make this into a documentary film that we could share with an international audience?
And the people in Dingmen that who you met, was it, so what I experienced in Matsu was that they felt they're very much of Republic of China. They didn't feel too much Taiwanese and they feel like they're stuck between Taiwan and China because they're, what happened to history? Things kept happening to them.
I do feel like over and over again, and then at least the folks that I come into contact with, which might be self-selecting, right? Because I'm making a documentary, so I was reaching out to folks that are interested in participating in that. They do talk about, you know, feeling marginalized, feeling like the majority in Taiwan, main island, don't necessarily embrace them as sort of fully part of Taiwan. They really hold on to the ROC identity very much. I'm generalizing, of course, right? But that does feel like that's a vibe there. They really treasure their cultural and economic relationship with, you know, Xiamen specifically, but, you know, mainland China in general. So that all feels very different. And I also, you know, sometimes I sense some anger there also of folks like, well, why do you guys treat us like this? Why do you exclude us when you talk about like the Taiwanese identity, et cetera? So which I totally do understand as well.
Did you meet many young people who were from Dingmen who were still in Dingmen?
I met a group of young people, and a lot of them are now sort of the cultural leaders of the community who left Dingmen, studied, and then decided to go back. So it was very intentional that they returned. You know, I think you can probably relate to that. And they're really invested in elevating Dingmen, elevating the culture there, elevating the history there, and also try to build an ecosystem that is conducive for other young people to come back and to thrive. I've also met some, you know, younger people who are mostly have been there, kind of try to figure out how to make a world for themselves in this really tricky environment.
Wow. Yeah, so, what do they do? And so in Matsu, what I saw was they own restaurants and Airbnbs.
Yeah. Very similar. And actually, funny enough, one of the events that I happened to capture was a exchange between the young leaders of Matsu and young leaders in Dingmen. So a group of folks came from Matsu and then they had this sort of symposium, like a full day of panels and discussions and whatnot. And it is very similar. Like in Dingmen, a lot of the B&Bs, and I imagine it's the same thing in Matsu, I'm not sure. But the Dingmen National Park, which I think is sort of really brilliant idea. As we know, or maybe some folks don't know, but in Taiwan, some of these heritage houses are in disrepair, not because people don't care or it's not worth anything. It's because the ownership is so splinter, you know, after two or three generations of being passed down, that it's hard to come to a decision to do anything. And a lot of the B&Bs in Dingmen are basically, the Dingmen National Park made a deal with some of these families and say, hey, let us fix up the house for you, or offer it up to be rented by interested party to run B&Bs, and then you guys benefit from having an income and we benefit from, you know, having more tourism infrastructure and also, you know, beautifying these really fantastic villages and communities. Some of these young people, actually quite a few of the people that I come across, that's what they do. And they are doing some things on the side. They're writers. They're exploring like opportunities to, you know, help the local artisans and local growers and farmers, you know, package goods for sales and for exports and stuff like that.
And what was your sense of economically, what was your sense of how Jingmen is changing? So Jingmen being so close to China, tourism really started after 2001 when a ferry between Jingmen and Xiamen began, influx of tourism. But then also we know Jingmen has a thriving alcohol industry, the Jingmen Gaoliang. With the Gaoliang industry, there's also an industry of Tao Qi. The knives are really popular.
From the bombs, right?
That's right.
Knives, not bomb.
But these are very traditional industries. Now Jingmen is home to 130,000 residents. But what's your sense of how economically it's changing there?
This is going to be quite anecdotal, that my observation. And by the way, it's 130 official registrants. So I think full-time residents are 60, 70. You know, the rest of the folks are people who live in main Taiwan Island or abroad.
Just half.
I think so.
Wow.
I didn't arrive in Jingmen until after the Xiaotantong stopped because of the pandemic. So what I saw were maybe not remnants, not quite the right word, but they're sort of infrastructural. Basically, because of the mainland tourists, Jingmen had invested a lot of money into things like shopping malls and big box stores and all of that. And I think for a while they were doing quite well, right? The tourism industry, they have tour guides who are geared towards the mainland tourists, the Chinese tourists. But now they're not coming. So I think that the last few years was probably quite challenging for a large group of folks that rely on that. And one of the surreal bits about it is if you go there, there are two huge, huge malls. One has like a 10, 12 theater multiplex, which for a fairly overall rural island was an interesting choice, but clearly they had made it for the tourists. And the other one was even bigger and to me sort of more surreal, is that it was like a ginormous 5-star hotel with duty-free mall attached to it for the mainland tourists to come and pick up goods and then bring it back across the water. So both of those are pretty empty right now. So I don't know what's going to happen to that. I know that a lot of the folks, especially in the tourism sector, they're really discussing how they need to diversify their tourism, which, you know, is always wise to do, how they can attract more tourists on the main Taiwanese island or international tourists for that matter.
Hey, if you have enjoyed the Taiwan Take and would like to support Ghost Island Media, we take monthly donations on Patreon. We're at patreon.com/Taiwan. And please give us a good rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. This helps other people find the show. All right, thank you. And back to the show.
You finished the film, you released it in December, and then comes the campaign to be in the Oscars. How have your team marketed this film to the Oscar judges?
We didn't necessarily plan this, but our timing was sort of impeccable. I think a lot of it is because of the election in January.
The Taiwanese election.
The Taiwanese presidential election. And also because in the last couple of years, there have been way more attention and more coverage of Taiwan than prior. Mm-hmm. That a lot of folks were chomping at the bits to want to find out more angles to talk about Taiwan. So when New York Times decided to launch our film in mid-December, it got attention pretty immediately. They're not supposed to release their numbers of views, but the staff there kind of told us on the download that we got hundreds of thousands of views within the first week, which is incredible.
Wow.
So besides the film being on New York Times, it's also on YouTube, on their YouTube channel, for free for the world. And now it's been like a little bit more than a month and we have 200,000 views, which for an independent documentary filmmaker is like, I mean, it's multiple times of maybe all of my audiences of all my work combined. But I feel very good about that, you know, because it, for us, this film, the goal of this film has always about eyeballs, mm-hmm. to get as many people to see this film as possible, to introduce Taiwan, at least just a slice, right? It's a glimpse. It's not meant to be comprehensive. It's not meant to be, you know, anything with authority, but it's just like a very personal way of saying, hey, this is actually what it's like for me and other people like me.
How does one submit your film to the Oscars?
So mechanically, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, which is the full name of the group that's behind the Oscars, they have a set of guidelines in terms of submission or requirements, if you will. But for the shorts, they're basically you have to either win at a designated film festival or you have to find a way to have a theatrical run in one of 8 designated U.S. cities in a commercial theater, movie theater that normally do play movies and sell tickets to audiences for 1 week before September 30th. 2023. So it's very, very finicky.
September 30th.
Yeah,
okay.
To qualify for this current cycle. Uh-huh. So we had quite a interesting, it was crazy.
I'm doing the math on the calendars right now.
It was crazy. We literally finished the film maybe like on the 25th of September.
Wow.
And I mean, the funny thing is it was such an afterthought. Basically, we finished the film and then it was Gene Chen, who's amazing.
Your producer.
Our producer, who is one of the, she's the most established Taiwanese American documentarian, and she's kind of the godmother to all of us Taiwanese in the US, Taiwanese here, and also Asian Americans in general, actually. She's helped so many people. Anyway, she just said, hey, maybe we should think about qualifying. I think, you know, we might have a chance. You know, I have some ideas about how we could try to get this out. And we're like, oh, okay, well, you know, we know the deadline's coming up, but, you know, maybe we can just like get a letter of commitment from a movie theater and then we can apply. But then when we looked at the guidelines, it was like, no, we had to be physically in the theater by September 30th. So, well, let's call some people and see if this is even remotely possible. And it was one of those things that like, it seems absurd that we would even try it. But when we start to make calls, everything kind of fell into place really quickly. Mm-hmm. And all the challenges that came up were solved in, you know, kind of like utilizing all of our experiences and relationships. So it felt a little bit like it was meant to be, you know.
So where did you screen the film in the end?
We ended up screening the film at Lemley Theaters, which is an art house theater chain in Southern California, in Lemley, North Hollywood. In the, I think, like the 1 p.m. slot for a week starting on September 29th or something like that. Yeah. We had just finished the film. We had barely submitted to any festivals. So we got invited to 2 festivals and we played at the 2 festivals. And then we just kind of, you know, went to work reaching out to our colleagues and friends in the community, try to get the word out, try to set up screenings.
Private screenings or public screenings?
Yeah, yeah, both private and public.
Did you know who was judging?
So how it works with the Oscars is actually different from like Golden Horse, for instance, where there's a jury. The Oscars is a voting body. There's 2 rounds to get to nomination, 3 rounds to win. The first round is to get to a short list of 15 out of, there was 130 submissions,
wow,
thereabouts. And then the second round is get from the 15 shortlist to 5 nominated films. So the first 2 rounds are voted only by the documentary branch of the Academy, and they're about 700 people, and they're all over the world. So these are our target audiences. I mean, mind you, I think the entire time we were also launching a New York Times, so we had quite exposure. I mean, it was very surreal to see my face on the New York Times homepage, which I would never imagine to ever happen. So that most definitely helped.
Walk us through behind the scene. What happens? How did you sign on New York Times Op Docs?
Initially, we were thinking about doing a feature-length documentary. Initially, the focus was going to be on the reopening of the ferry of Xiaosantong. I am kind of fascinated by the relationship that Jimin has with the Chinese tourists, that sort of symbiotic relationship, but with a lot of right? Layers of complication that could happen. So I wanted to see, like in my mind, there'd be all these folks in the tourism sector working really hard to get the ferry going again. And then I'll see, you know, sort of the flock of tourists come in and then get their interaction. That was not how it happened. As we know, the pandemic lasted quite a bit longer and the ferry has reopened then, but it's in a way that's much more restrictive, especially for the Chinese passport holders. And also the decision on whether or not the ferry opens or not is not the Jinmen's decision. It's decided by the government here in Taipei and the government in Beijing, right? So we had to kind of reconceive this film. And then at some point, we decided that it makes sense to do a short film to kind of do this almost atmospheric film of these vignettes of the local lives. So that's very much the first cut, was just some of the scenes you've seen in the final cut, but without me, without my story. We show this to New York Times. I've had a relationship with them from prior projects that we were in discussions for. And when they saw the rough cut, when New York Times op-doc saw the rough cut, their reactions were, we love the subject matter. We love how beautiful the imageries are. We're missing a strong point of view. So what can you guys do to elevate that? And then in conversations with Jin Chen, our producer, and then with some other advisors, I mean, I remember Jean telling me this. She's like, well, Leo, you need to actually figure out in your mind, decide and be able to articulate why you're making this film. Like, what is it in the deepest part of your heart that you feel like this is the story you want to tell now? So that's actually how we ended up with me in the film, is that I feel like weirdly, like I relate to Jinmen as a place because of the in-betweenness, you know, that it occupies and also myself occupies as a transnational person who moves around in these spaces and don't feel completely belonging of any of the spaces that I'm in, which I think you can relate.
Yes.
So yeah, that's how we ended up with this film. And when we kind of came to that point, New York Times was like, great, this is what we want. I mean, you know, there were a bunch of notes, but they officially came on board and we went from there.
What was that consideration like to insert yourself into the film? Because for documentaries, to insert that director's personal voice, narration in there can make or break the film.
My biggest consideration was that I really wanted, at least the initial idea was for Jinmeners to tell their own story. I worked in the last stretch of the most recent stretch of my career to really empower, like to not have these sort of parachuting ways of storytelling, people coming in, not really knowing the place very well, you know, force themselves to become the voice of this place that they don't know very well. I didn't want to do that for Jinmen. But when the idea came up to think about putting myself in the film, I realized that this was kind of like a two-character story, right? Me being one of the main characters and Jinmen, the place, being the other main character. And the film is very much about how the two characters are in conversation with each other. And then about how this conversation hopefully resulted in something that gave the world a better idea of what being Taiwanese is about. So when we kind of sorted that out in our head, we felt like, oh yeah, this could work. You know, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be something new for me. As a documentarian, I'm more like an observational guy. I like to follow a set of characters, not me, over long periods of time. And to think that I have to drive this story was quite daunting. But I also saw it as a challenge. I do feel like I'm at a point of my career where I need to grow. And I'm also been contemplating a longer first-person sort of autobiographical piece, that this work that I did on Island in Between very much fits what I was doing with the other piece. So, you know, so I kind of embraced it with obviously support from the team and from friends and colleagues who advised me.
I thought you struck a really nice balance between giving your personal perspective, but then giving space for whether it's that vignette or that shot or the character, and then having their stories leap through in the different parts.
Thank you. The writing of the narration was it was actually kind of a wonderful experience in a way that was sort of super eye-opening. We actually ended up bringing in a consultant and a documentary editor in the US that I super respect, David Teague, who had edited one of my favorite documentary films, Cutie and the Boxer. I don't know if you heard about it. It's about this Japanese-American, actually sort of Japanese immigrant artists, this couple in New York. Anyway, it's a fabulous film. You can get hold of it. You should watch it. And I ended up, and I now joke, I was like, you're not our consulting writer. You're my narration therapist, you know? So basically, he, instead of digging in, jumping in right away about Jinmen or about Taiwan or whatever, he just gave me all these prompts that were very much about, like, you know, what do you think your biggest strength is? What is your biggest fear? You know, how do you see your parents? What are their biggest powers? What is your biggest disappointment in life? It was very existential, right? And I was like, God, this is brilliant. This is exactly what I need. Because what we're trying to do is to get to the emotional core of why I wanted to tell this story, and the emotional core of my relationship with Taiwan, really. It's a lot of things and thoughts that I have, but have not had the opportunity to organize them or to speak them out loud and to speak them out loud and look at them and then organize them, you know, which ended up being the process of the narration writing for me.
All right, let's hold on to that. The relationship with Taiwan, which I really want to ask about. We're going to take a little short break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about your personal journey, your relationship to Taiwan.
Hey, if you have enjoyed the Taiwan Take and would like to support Ghost Island Media, we take monthly donations on Patreon. We're at patreon.com/Taiwan. Thank you. And back to the show.
Welcome back. We've been talking to S. Leo Jiang, who is documentary Island in Between has just been nominated for an Oscars. I want to ask you about your journey as a Taiwanese parachute kid in the United States. So you grew up in Taiwan until you were...
15 years old. I'm a southerner. I'm from Kaohsiung. My parents actually still live there. They never left because, you know, I parachuted into the U.S.
For some of our listeners who may not be familiar with the term parachute.
My definition, I guess, is when parents, and during my era, right, mostly East Asian parents from here, from Taiwan, from Korea, Hong Kong, and I think recently more from China, that send their children to the U.S. for education and to live and maybe to somehow gain legal status without them themselves being, you know, immigrating there.
So these are children who move to a different country for the purpose of education without their parents with them. Parachute kids live with relatives or host families, boarding schools, or sometimes parents will have an apartment and the kids live there on their own.
Yeah. Caretakers. I went to San Jose, California, and there were families like mine where usually the mother that goes back and forth. They travel both sides of the Pacific and maybe spend a stretch of a couple months with them. And then they have to come back to Taiwan and spend time here. And then I also have friends who live basically in like a boarding house, right? It's not a boarding school, but it's a house run often by a Taiwanese immigrant family. Again, usually a woman. And then they will be hosting three kids, five kids in the house. My family, we had initially planned that my mother was going to be the astronaut, as the term, the analogy continues in terms of the flying and the parachuting and to go back and forth between Taiwan and U.S. But unfortunately, my mom actually got ill unexpectedly after we moved there and passed away really quickly. Thank you. And so a couple of years later, so we were largely on our own. We did have an uncle and his wife there, so they look after us. We had some family friends looked after us, but we were the envy of our friends, our American friends. We were like, what do you mean you don't have any parents around? You can do whatever you want.
Do you remember whether you had a particular sense of what being Taiwanese meant back then as an early immigrant?
You know, I mean, I grew up in a generation where I don't think the Taiwanese identity, at least for those of us who lived in, I mean, I don't know if it's even fair to say sort of like the quote unquote mainstream Taiwanese or mainstream ROC, you know,
this
society.
Is late 80s.
Yeah. So basically, I left Taiwan learning one set of Taiwanese history. And when I returned, after the martial law was lifted, I had to relearn an entire history. And my identity was very much tied to that first set of history that I learned about China, about us being Chinese, about China being rightfully ours, which is such an absurd concept now looking back. And so when I was in the U.S., I think that the Chinese American or even just Chinese was really my main identity. I did have a lot of Taiwanese friends who were in similar situations as me. But I think that the outward identity that I expressed, that I talked about, was one of being a Chinese immigrant.
You had just left in the mid-80s before martial law was lifted. Kaohsiung was this active place for pro-democracy movements in Kaohsiung. The Meilidao had just happened. How do you look at that now?
You know, I keep saying that. I don't know if this is true or not, but I told my parents that I remember the day of the Meilidao event. How do you characterize that? I don't know.
Kaohsiung incident. Okay, the Formosa incident.
The Formosa incident. I just remember the adults were very nervous and they told us kids, and I was very young then, to like not go out, you know, like something is happening and just be careful. Because actually, I mean, my family home is like on Zhongzheng Road, which is down the street from the Meilidao, the Formosa. And I think the protest took place near the office of the magazine or the publication or something, right? So that was really the extent of my memory. And then I remember at that point, anything that has to do with sort of people supporting Taiwanese independence was seen as subversive, right? At least that's how I was taught, that they're actually communist sympathizers, that they try to do this to destabilize our society and all of that. So that was very much the narrative that I learned growing up. Obviously, that narrative has evolved many fold since then. And so coming back, it's been really interesting. It's been really interesting to see, you know, Chen Ju becoming, you know, the Kaohsiung mayor, and to see the democracy evolve the way it has.
Because now, looking back, the Formosa incident really was the pivotal event that forced Taiwan into democracy.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny to think that I was here for a lot of it, but I didn't get to see the moment, at least in person, when the transition, well, I guess it was not one moment, but the period of the transition.
So did you stay in touch with Taiwan over the years, the 15 years you were in the U.S.?
I think I was a terrible Taiwanese American. I had very confused and mixed feelings about my Taiwanese-ness. And also, I think that going to the U.S., the priority was so much about integration that I think in many ways I turned my back on my Taiwanese-ness when I was really young, as a teenager in my early 20s, because I was desperately wanted to fit in as an American. So I felt I was actually quite disconnected to Taiwan. And also because my mom passed away and you know, my father, we obviously have a good relationship with them. But just for one reason or another, it was not the priority in my life during that period of time. So in many ways, I had to rebuild and relearn my relationship with Taiwan. And that kept evolving as well.
Yeah, I can sympathize with that. I mean, I was that parachute kid in the mid-90s. And this was the time before internet, before K-pop, or before Japanese manga was cool. Back then, you had to integrate. You had to learn, you had to catch up on what children listened to when they were five. That was the priority then.
Yeah. And also being an immigrant at that time, like you were teased, right? If you speak with an accent, if you don't know what certain words meant, you know, if you don't know certain bands or cultural references, like you were just sort of further ostracized. I wouldn't say that like I necessarily suffered, but it was a difficult time, right? I mean, in any kind of transition like that, very drastic transition.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to get back in touch with the Taiwan that's today?
Well, I think that when I started to come back regularly, that I really did have the desire of somehow rebuild some kind of relationship or strengthen whatever the ties that was still there in a much more substantial and meaningful way. And I did sort of always was looking for opportunity to either move back or spend more time here or get projects going here. At the same time in the U.S., I was getting involved more in the Asian American community, not necessarily as an activist or as a scholar or anything, but as a filmmaker, you know, because it just felt natural that I wanted to tell those stories. I want to tell immigrant stories. Ended up doing a lot of work about the Vietnamese American community who I built connection with, because in San Jose during that time in high school, most of the people that look like me, I mean, there's a huge population of Vietnamese Americans and a huge population of Filipino.
The largest Vietnamese community outside of Vietnam is in California.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a huge portion of my friends, the community of friends I had in high school were Vietnamese Americans. So I always felt a kinship with them, you know, even though obviously a lot of them went through the trauma and hell that I couldn't even imagine. But the displacement and the sort of searching for a sense of belonging, all of that felt very resonant for me. So I was both traveling back to the...
You won an Emmy for that film.
I was nominated
for an Emmy. You were nominated. Oh, sorry. You were nominated for an Emmy.
But it was an incredible acknowledgement.
You're a part of a collective called ADOCS. Tell me about this.
Yeah, ADOC is a short for Asian American Documentary Network. And it was actually founded, it was started by me and my colleague and friend, Grace Lee, the incredible Korean-American documentarian, in collaboration with Renee Tajima Pena, who's a Japanese-American documentarian who was an Oscar nominee and is another one of those giant figures in the Asian-American space. We started the group, the network, in 2016, you know, kind of in reaction to the fact that there were really... wasn't a filmmaker-driven entity that was speaking on behalf of the filmmakers. Again, there are several organizations in the U.S. that has done incredible work on Asian American representation in media, like places like Center for Asian American Media in San Francisco, CAM, which produce a lot of work for U.S. public television, and Visual Communications, which runs a really wonderful L.A. Asian Pacific Film Festival. But we felt like the filmmakers have things to say, and we want to be part of all these wonderful groups that help to amplify Asian American stories. So we started that group, and just really on a very basic concept of like, if you get a bunch of folks together, magical things will happen. So we do meetups. We actually sponsor filmmakers to attend industry events, and we actually also been producing short Asian American stories, films for PBS, for the internet, for festivals.
I love that. If you get the best people together, magic will happen.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, people are brilliant and smart, and oftentimes it's about making the connections for them, right?
Back then, not as many transnational or third culture kids came back to Taiwan at the time, mostly stayed in the U.S. It wasn't until after 2007, after the recession, that a lot of Asian Americans or Asian in America came back to Asia.
I did try to come back in 2004 one time.
How long did you stay in 2004? That was the middle of Chen Shui-bian's term, the first DPP administration.
Only a year. And I ended up taking a job to go to Singapore. And then that job actually took me to China for the first time. I was working for this production company that was producing stuff like factual travel shows, hosted shows for television. So I was doing a travel show in China, and that brought me to China for the first time.
In 05, 06.
Yeah, yeah.
How did living in China at the time change how you saw yourself as a Taiwanese? Did it?
I mean, I didn't live there. I just could come in and out. Yeah, I mean, it did, because now my Chinese-ness, right? The Chinese-ness that I built and learned growing up is now in the context of China, where I'm actually, you're Taiwanese, like within 2 seconds after you open your mouth. They know you're Taiwanese, and then there's a different relationship, and then there's a different understanding. And I'm also at these places where maybe I read about or learned about, but like it felt totally foreign to me. It felt like, yes, we're speaking the same language, and we're supposed to have all these commonalities, but we're very different people. You know, we're operating on very different wavelengths. So that definitely made me think about my Taiwanese-ness much more. But maybe Taiwanese-ness in the context of Chinese-ness more than Taiwanese-ness in the context of global identity.
What's coming up for you next?
Yeah, I would like to continue to explore sort of my transnational existence, if you will, you know, in my next projects. I've been working on a personal film that's related to my experience as a parachute kid, but really it's kind of a larger exploration of my Taiwanese/American/Taiwanese-American/Chinese/Chinese-American identity. But hopefully in a much more human and casual way and not as academic as that might sound, right? So that's one big project that I'm working on. You know, I also sort of produce other filmmakers' films, and I have other ideas that I want to explore. So all of that is coming up after this current period of nuttiness is over.
I do believe that a lot of our identity with our home and with our countries, it's an evolving relationship depending on our age and locations. But how you've captured where you are at this moment into this 19-minute film, it's a beautiful look. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come into the studio and speak to us. Thank you for making the film, and congratulations on the success so far.
Thank you so much, Emily. And it's been fun chatting.
S. Leo Jiang, his film Island in Between, is available on the New York Times Op Docs and also on the New York Times YouTube. For audiences who have not seen the film, we will have the link in the show notes. But also, can you tell us, where can we find you on socials?
All my social handles are S. Leo Chiang, S-L-E-O-C-H-I-A-N-G. I am on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram.
All right, we'll have all these links in the show notes. This has been a Ghost Island Media production based in Taipei, Taiwan. I am Emily Waiwu. Thanks for listening. See you next time.